Drama on the Duval County School Board as the superintendent faces an attempted coup. Eureka Garden has a new owner, and Mayor Curry sits down with the unions. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or the WJCT app. And just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line right now at 549-2937. Then later, Olympic gold medalist Michelle Kwan on why she's getting political this election year, plus the music of the Dal Una Ensemble. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first, it's Friday, and the roundtable is here with WJCT's Lindsay Kilbride. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
Tessa Duval of the Florida Times Union.
Hey, good morning.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
Hello.
And editor Claire Goforth of Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
What a great group and a lot to discuss. Everything from a new owner for the troubled Eureka Garden Complex to Mayor Curry's latest move with local unions and more. But our top story, the drama this week between Duval County Superintendent Nicolai Vitti and the Duval County School Board. Vitti said Monday he will not step down from his position in spite of a request and a threat to fire that's been widely reported this week by board chairwoman Ashley Smith Juarez. There's a lot to get into here, and in just about an hour, there will be a special meeting of the school board, which is sure to be even more high drama. But we're going to begin the hour with your thoughts about this standoff. Give us a call with your thoughts about the turmoil on the school board between the members and the superintendent by giving us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937, or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show or weigh in on Facebook. Lindsay Kilbride, you've been covering this for some time. You'll be at the special meeting. Initially, board chair Ashley Smith Juarez said it was reported that she asked for Vitti's resignation, saying she didn't feel he was being aggressive enough in trying to close the achievement gap between African-American and Caucasian students. Now she's walked that back, saying that she does not intend to ask for him to step down, but that she and the board are prepared to work things out. What's going on?
Well, it's sort of hard to figure out what's going down. I can just go from the beginning, which is board member Scott Shine sent me an email just, alleging she was going to have him fired or call for a vote on his contract on Friday. I talked to him on the phone, and he said Vitti told him that she had asked him to step down, and then when he didn't, she called this meeting to vote on his contract. I asked Vitti if this was true. I sent him the quote. He said this is accurate. So we sort of reported that this is what's going on. She hadn't responded to the media. Then she just responded with an open letter. Still didn't address whether she was seeking to vote on his contract or not, but she did acknowledge that she had asked for him to step down, but then also said, you know, she's always willing to work through things, but the letter, she was very direct in that she was displeased with how students were performing. And then when she spoke to media, she said, if I knew a vote on his contract was imminent, I would have scheduled it that way.
She would have noticed it publicly.
Yeah, she noticed the meeting using more vague language than that.
Yeah. Here's Scott Shine, the board member that alerted the media that he believed this was happening. Take a listen.
I actually had heard about this and asked Dr. Vitti, and he told me explicitly that he had been having ongoing conversations with Smith Juarez, that she had given him an ultimatum to resign. He said he would not resign. She said she would schedule this meeting to terminate him.
Okay, and here is Nicolai Vitti responding.
You know, I came here three and a half years ago, knowing that the district needed a reformer. It asked for a reformer. And when you're going about the work of reforming a large urban school district, it's hard work. It's going to lead to tension, conflict, and disagreements. And I have tried hard not to take anything personally. And I continue to do that. And I think you have to do that when you're a reform leader.
And finally, here's board chair Ashley Smith Juarez.
If I intended to put a vote on the floor that I knew was imminent, I would have published it in the agenda. I would not have withheld that from the public. I noticed the meeting with 7 days notice. I can call a meeting within 24 hours. So the idea that that was somehow withheld, I'm not sure where that came from.
Tessa Duval, who's telling the truth here?
With the school board, who knows? I mean, this is a school board that has had a lot of drama in the last year. I mean, it's if you think back to about a year ago, it was Paula and Connie who consistently were having problems with the superintendent and raised concerns about the language he was using in addressing them. And now it seems that Ashley's board chair, and she's very emboldened and is making a lot of the same points that other school board members have made about the achievement gap and, mm-hmm. and underperforming schools. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, but who can predict?
Right. Certainly a tense meeting set to take place across the river from where we sit in just about an hour. AG.
Right. I mean, in terms of attempted coups, this went about as well as one in Turkey earlier this summer. The board member from the Clinton Foundation made a power play, then seemingly backed down from it. And, you know, this would have been a time to make the move if you're going to make the move. You got a six-person board. The chair has a tie-breaking vote. So all she would really need is herself, you know, or Hall, Wright, or Couch. I mean, two of those three would have gotten the job done. And, you know, you got to raise the question, like, why does she back down? She got pressure from people like Ed Burb, the Civic Council, Audrey Moran, other community leaders of that type. And, you know, the rumor is, you know, either you back down from this or we're going to crush your political career. She should have seen that going in because VD has been rubber stamped by the chamber, by the Civic Council, by all of these people. So, you know, why take it to the brink and then pull it back? And if you've got VD, you've got Shine with the same narrative, you've got her on one side, it does become a sort of, you know, who do you believe, her or them? And, you know, she's done the impossible here. She's made Nikolai VD a sympathetic figure. You know, we've been here for 3 years, and this is the first time you can say, you know, I feel sorry for VD. He's getting done wrong. And, you know, that's an unintended consequence of, you know, brinksmanship that you don't follow through on.
Claire Goforth, if that is in fact what's happening, what does that say about the way power works in this city?
I mean, the city's elite, they again and again circle the wagons around their boy or their girl, whoever it is, and they say, no, they're untouchable. We want this person to stay in this position. I think it is interesting that Ashley Smith-Juarez waited how many months after the test results came out to start crowing about the achievement gap and implying in her open letter quite clearly that it was the result of racist policies by a superintendent who's married to an African-American woman and has a beautiful family with her. It came across as tone deaf, I think. The achievement gap is something that has been ongoing in this country. 50 years ago, the results from, it was the Coleman Report, found that the achievement gap was very startling between white and black students, and today it remains almost unchanged. If you want to blame Duval County Superintendent of Schools for a national issue like that, I mean, people aren't foolish. They're not going to think that holds that much water, really.
Okay. And Lindsay, you've been covering these workshops,
yeah.
and you've witnessed the interaction between these members and the superintendent for some time.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a little more context about why Smith-Juarez, you think is going, what tried to go forward with this.
Well, you know, and again, everyone's reporting that she had intended to have him fired today, and we don't know that for sure. We can say that, you know, it was a noticed special board meeting, which isn't typical of a conversation. That's a workshop normally, but, you know, who knows? But I think going back to the achievement issues, they've been having these for a while. Specifically, though, recently, because she hasn't been one who was as vocally, I don't want to say not concerned, but she's a lot more vocal now than she used to be. It was mostly Wright and Hall and then Couch who had been voicing these concerns the most. You know, in fact, there was a literacy plan, an annual literacy plan that three board members voted against, I think a month ago or so, and she voted for it. But at the same time, you know, her concerns are related to some specifics that have happened recently, which is that some of the achievement gaps between races are widening this year compared to last, and that's information they just requested and got. So that's something that she just recently seemed to have had concerns over because they just got the information on that. It was also VD's evaluation, and it was pretty astonishing, her comments, because I had never really seen her voice her concerns like that before, and they were very, very blunt and forward in her comments. But also, another thing that recently happened in the last couple months is that she had been asking for a gifted center on the north side. They were basically retooling their gifted plan. They worked on this for a few months. It normally doesn't take this long for an annual plan to reapprove, but they really did rework this to put more gifted in middle schools. And he came back and he didn't fulfill the request that they asked, which was to identify a center on the north side that could work for this. And at that point, she was sort of like, why did you not listen to what I specifically asked?
She felt you didn't follow through with what she asked.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah.
Okay, let's go to the jammed phone lines right now on this topic. Lomax on the south side. Hi, Lomax. Good morning.
How you doing?
Good.
Good morning. So, I think Mr. How do you pronounce his name? Anyway, the superintendent, he's a very professional man, and he was superintendent up in Annapolis when I left in 2010 to come down here.
Nikolai Vidi?
Yeah.
Okay.
You ever heard?
I knew he came from Miami previously to Jacksonville. I didn't know.
Oh,
he'd
yeah,
been
he was. He's in, from Miami. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but you liked him there,
ma'am.
You liked him in Indianapolis.
Well, he tried to institute a dress code, and I don't know if his hands were tied or not, but never enforced it.
Mm-hmm.
And now I hear Curry's eliminated corporal punishment in our schools. Is that true?
Well, no. The mayor doesn't have any control over what the school board does.
Well, I've been misinformed then, because I thought I heard that on the radio.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go to Royal in Orange Park. Hi, Royal. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are we guys doing?
Good.
So I heard you guys talking about the contentious relationship between the superintendent and the school board. And for me personally, I think that a contentious relationship between the superintendent and the school board and what the chairperson had reportedly attempted to do is sort of challenging the checks and balances that the superintendent's position and the board is supposed to exist for. I don't think it's a coincidence that this meeting was scheduled during a school day when none of the teachers and none of the community could actually come and observe it unless they took time off of work. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the newest representative of the school board, who represents some of the DTO schools in the district and some of the largest concentrations of African American students in the district, isn't going to be able to sit in on that. There are two seats vacant now, and you know those two seats are pretty major seats. Why now hold a vote about the direction that the school district is going in? Why not wait for Warren Jones to take his seat and actually be able to represent the voters in the district that he has earned the right to represent? I just think that's a crazy action on Ms. Warren's part.
Okay, thank you for that. Tessa.
You know, I think it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds. You know, I think we'll see it walk back more than likely, because I think there will be that perception that, you know, you can't do this while you're a person down, especially with such a crucial seat empty. You know, but I just want to go back to the point that this achievement gap has really been something that Paula and Connie have been emphasizing for a long time, and Becky had gotten on board with as well. And so now, now it is being taken more seriously, I think, now that Ashley is bringing it up, because people just weren't listening before.
Mm.
So hopefully this does at least give some weight to those issues. But, you know, you can't make a decision like this in secret and during the day and when people can't be there. So let's just hope that, you know, we take our time on this.
And lots of calls as we talk about the top stories of the week on our Friday roundtable. Mike is on the south side. Hi, Mike. Good morning.
Hello.
Hey, go ahead.
Hey, all right. I got to say that anybody that thinks that Beattie's not being aggressive is not paying attention. I think one of the problems with this, with her, whatever you want to call what she did, an attack or what have you, just a complete misfire, because it really kind of detracts from, I mean, Nikki, Beattie's not terrible, but he's certainly generated a lot of criticism for some things that I think a lot of people feel very frustrated with. But this, whatever she's done, however she's done it, has just completely taken away everything from that and aimed it towards just a non-issue. He's just as aggressive as any other superintendent trying to solve some of these problems. And I think it's kind of frustrating when somebody lobs something ridiculous like this out there, and just I got to look at it as just a complete misfire on her part. If she really wanted to get something done, her criticism should have been more directed towards a lot of things that people were already irritated about. So okay. I would be interested in hearing some what maybe some other legitimate criticisms some people have of Vitti that maybe aren't. I don't want to make a pile on a Vitti, but maybe if some the folks on the panel can speak to some of the obvious successes or some of the obvious issues that he's having, that would be great.
Yep.
I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike. Okay, let's talk about that.
I mean, when we try to hold one single person accountable for an achievement gap affecting Black students, I think that we're not recognizing the reality that it's so complicated, involving economics and geography. It's just, it's more than one man can achieve, and it's way more than one man can achieve in 3 years.
And as you pointed out, Claire, Nicolae Vitti is certainly getting the strong backing of the city's power elite. He does not necessarily always have the backing of the rank and file throughout the school district, where the changes he's made and his personal style, which is aggressive and blunt, that hasn't always gone over well with the board and the teacher groups. AG, what about that?
Yeah, I mean, historically, there's a cycle with school district superintendents. You have the outside reformer guy who's beloved by business community. He gets run for some reason. Sometimes it's spurious, sometimes it isn't. Then they bring in the union-friendly guy for a few years, and then the cycle repeats. You know, Vitti does not do a good job marketing himself to the rank and file in the district. Doesn't do a really good job marketing himself to the rank and file, you know, in the city. You know, Vitti has talked throughout his tenure about, you know, why the achievement gaps exist. I mean, part of it is, you know, socioeconomic, as Claire was saying. If you're not getting reinforcement of basic skills at the home, you know, what is it supposed to do? I mean, you look at gaps in the school district, you look at, say, Scott Shine's district out at the beach, A schools. You look at Jason Fisher's district, you know, former district in the South Side, went from A to B. What happened in that district? The demographics changed. You had more renters. You had more broken homes. And, you know, that's really what's driving it. So, you know, Nicolae Vitti, you know, can't fix social pathologies any more than a Jacksonville Sheriff's Office can fix social pathologies. And, you know, until we have a real dialogue about that, you know, we basically are having a fallacious discourse because, you know, you're not going to get to the real answer until you get to the reasons that we're having gaps, not just in educational achievement, but in, you know, nutrition and in outcomes and income and on throughout.
I'm going to take one more call on this and then we'll move on to the other news of the week. Elizabeth in Julington Creek. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning. I think I would like to echo some of the comments recently made that we expect someone to come in and turn around something that has been historically challenging for how many years. We're not going to turn it around in a year. We're not going to turn it around in 3 years. And what should have happened is to say, let us look at the things he has accomplished. And then where are the areas of challenge? And then let us work together instead of this hijacking and total undermining for political moves of the superintendent. St. John's County has had a superintendent for the last, 15 years? And I think it speaks to why the results are the way they are in St. John's County. We keep changing superintendents every 3, 4, 5 years, probably not even as long as 5 years. This needs to stop. And people need to be honest about some of the reasons why the achievement gap is there. It takes a village. And we are in total denial and expect one person to come in and wave a magic wand and say, guess what? Everybody is up to par. Let us look at what he has done and then let us challenge him to do better in those areas where he needs challenging. Because to go through a search process at this point and bring in something totally new is ridiculous.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Thanks for that. Tessa, you were shaking your head at some of that.
it's unfair to compare Duval schools to St. John County schools. I mean, the demographics, the income are just totally different. And like we've talked about on this panel, that when you have, you know, systemic poverty and you have nutrition issues and you know, you have parents who are either unwilling or unable to help kids with their schooling at home, you cannot compare the two districts. They are not alike. And they never will be in that regard. And that's okay. You know, Duval is a large urban district in a way that St. John's County is not. And we just have to acknowledge that we have a different set of challenges here.
And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the top stories of the week. We're going to move on now and talk about a vice presidential visit. Also making headlines this week, Libertarian vice presidential candidate Bill Weld came to town, the former governor of Massachusetts, saying the two major parties shouldn't have a lock on elections and policy. Weld packed a hall at JU Thursday night and talked about his ticket's message of fiscal conservatism and social liberalism.
They're assuming that you cannot have an alternative to the R and the D monopoly. I don't think they've done such a great job with their monopoly in Washington the last 15 years, frankly. You know, it's poisonously partisan down there, hard to get anything done. And it's like the two parties in Washington exist with very little other thought than to kill each other.
Okay. Gary Johnson and William Weld are going to try to crack 15% in the polls, Lindsay, to try to get on the debate stage for debates 2 and 3 so that the screens aren't filled only by Clinton and Trump. Can they do it?
I don't know. I mean,
A.G. Gankarski. Do they even have a shot to crack that 15% threshold?
History tells us and recent polling tells us that the support for the third party candidate is trailing off as the binary opposition takes hold. You know, people like to back a winner. You know, that being said, Bill Weld at JU last night actually advanced some interesting policy prescriptions. You know, he came out in favor of the TPP. You know, he came out in favor of social liberalism, basically taking these positions that were Koch brothers friendly, that were friendly to the economic libertarian wing of the Republican Party that's been superseded by the Trump ascension. And the big question, you know, Weld being on the ticket was supposed to unlock the doors to Koch brothers money. It was supposed to unlock the doors to the big donors. You know, it didn't happen. They've raised about $10 million in this campaign. And, you know, we notice covering campaigns on a local level, on a state level, you know, money is the oxygen. If the Johnson-Weld ticket had raised $50 million, $100 million, it would be a different conversation. But as it is, they're not able to buy the paid media, and when they get the earned media, it's often focusing on what is Aleppo and gaps like that.
Right, and you know, that came up when Weld was on the program this week, Claire. The man at the top of the ticket, Gary Johnson, made a major gaffe when he seemed not to understand that Aleppo is in war-torn Syria. Some have even posed the thought that Weld should have been at the top of that ticket rather than Johnson, something he poo-pooed when he spoke with us.
Yeah, that was a pretty terrible gaffe on his part. But to his credit, subsequently, he has been extremely open and apologetic and said, I made a mistake and I should not have. I should have known that. I think that is the kind of response that you rarely see from a mainstream party a candidate like Donald Trump. I don't really see him ever apologizing for anything he says or does. Same with Hillary Clinton. I'm sure she would apologize, but it would probably come across as mealy-mouthed, and then half the electorate would say she was lying. So, good job on his part for apologizing.
And, you know, there's certainly a groundswell of support in some quarters for this ticket, Tessa, but the old saying is that as the leaves fall, so does support for third-party candidates when it gets down to the last weeks. Are we going to see this again?
You know, I was at a conference earlier this week where I heard some interesting numbers about Florida voters I just want to share because they were very surprising to me. So among Florida voters, a quarter are millennials and 24% are Gen Xers. And then among the millennials, one-third are no-party affiliates. So I think, you know, it's hard to know how they're going to vote. I think among young people especially, you know, you grew up with the Clinton in the White House before, and who knows what you think about Donald Trump. And so people see this, you know, social liberalism and conservative fiscal approach, and they kind of like it because, you know, the studies tell us that millennials aren't making a lot of money. And so the thought of keeping what you've got is probably appealing, while social issues like gay marriage and marijuana legalization are very appealing to young people. So it could be interesting to see how many of these millennial non-party registered voters go with a third party candidate.
Dennis at the Beaches. Hi, Dennis. Good morning.
Good morning. I like the idea of the third party, but when you get a leader of the third party ticket that makes all these foolish gaffes, like the most recent one I read where he was saying we don't need to worry about taking care of the earth because the sun's going to burn it up anyway. You know, what planet is this guy on? I'm sorry. I just, you know, that defeats the whole purpose of trying to go with a third party ticket when you got people that have those kind of views. That's all I got.
Thanks, Dennis.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that quote, so I'll have to research that one. That being said, Tessa made some interesting points about the preponderance of Gen Xers, of millennials, and of independents. This jibes neatly with what the Johnson-Weld ticket has been saying. You know, they are the choice of independents. They're the choice of young voters. Now, here's the problem. You look at your high-propensity voters on the right, they tend to be over 65. They tend to be kind of your early bird buffet types. You look at the Democrat high-propensity voters, they're your union types. You know, they're basically in that range.
I like early bird buffets, by the way.
I do, too.
I'm not 65, but anyway, but, I'm so sorry. You know,
that,
go right ahead.
That being said, you know, how do you turn out these people? I mean, this is kind of the problem that in the mayoral race locally, Bill Bishop was having, because Bill Bishop was not a viable candidate by most measures. He had a fraction of the money of Alvin Brown and Lenny Curry. You know, he got up close to 20%, and you know, that was kind of a best case scenario. So
he was like the local version of Gary Johnson.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't polished. He, you know, said things that seemed inherently contradictory. He wasn't focus grouped. He couldn't afford a consultant. And this is kind of the role that Gary Johnson is in. Can Gary Johnson get up to 15-20% if everything breaks right? You know, if people really do see that, well, you know, Trump is appalling, Clinton's untrustworthy, you know, so I'm willing to throw away the vote, so to speak, you know, to get a third party in there. And really, their strength is out west. You look at Utah, look at New Mexico, look at Colorado, places like that. All they really need to do is win one state, and this whole thing is turned into the House of Representatives, and that's when it gets interesting, because does the House of Representatives really align with Donald Trump? Did their donor base really align with Donald Trump? It is an uneasy marriage, and it's one that, if it could be turned into the House, all bets may be off.
All right, let's make note of a couple of other headlines from the week. On Tuesday, officials announced an Ohio-based company wants to buy the troubled low-income housing complex Eureka Garden. Mayor Lenny Curry told reporters he's optimistic about it after a phone call with the CEO of Millennia Housing Management. Claire Goforth, will this mean, though, an improvement in the conditions there?
Temporarily. I think that'll be what happens. For a few months, they'll be doing everything right, and they'll be fixing it all. And then a year from now, that'll start happening again. Things will start to deteriorate. And the reason I say that is because that's what's been happening at Eureka Garden for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
not too optimistic then, are we?
Not really. I mean, an Ohio-based company is going to buy it and save the day down here. I don't see that happening.
Tessa?
It does seem like the HUD reviewing practices and inspection practices are coming to be looked at a little more closely. So I think that could be a concern for optimism. I understand that having this distant landlord again could, you know, we could see ourselves in the same situation with that. But if the HUD practices are criticized more closely, that could be cause for optimism.
And also this week, speaking of the mayor, right after voters approved his sales tax extension plan to bring down the billions we're suffering in pension costs, city employee unions are negotiating the terms of closing those plans to new members. The mayor says his administration is going to put forth a solution, but very light on the details. Lindsay Kilbride.
Yeah, I mean, this is the time for the unions to start making their demands. I know one of the major unions is asking for a retroactive 2% raise that never was settled. So we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, one of the plans at least has to be closed, but I know he wants all of them closed. So.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to see.
Yeah, but how are we going to attract the kind of talent and people that are willing to take the lower rate of pay that we give our police in Duval County if they're not promised a pension? That's a good question to be answered.
You know, this is the thing. Lenny Curry may have had his political apex with the passing of the referendum because the unions are going to hit him and hit him hard. You know, the reason they gave him support was because they felt they could win at the bargaining table. There are going to have to be concessions made. What are those concessions going to be? You know, how long is Lenny Curry willing to wait it out? If he is negotiating these pension deals as the election approaches in 2019, then it gets really interesting. You know, then you see the politicians come out of the woodwork and, you know, kind of do what Lenny did to Alvin Brown, doing well-timed op-eds, basically, you know, undermine the administration's position on one issue or the other. And, you know, this is kind of a thing. There is a time element to this, and there is a public perception element to it. And, you know, Lenny Curry wanted to support these unions on the referendum. He got it. He courted it over a course of months with town hall meetings with every department in the city. And, you know, now the piper wants to be paid.
Yeah. Okay. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida. And only in Florida do people steal naked Donald Trump statues.
I was just looking for a friend.
In Miami, a Coral Gables man is wanted in connection with the theft of those now infamous naked Trump statues. This one was stolen from Wynwood. It had been in the neighborhood for about a week. Security guards saw the statue in the buff of the Republican presidential candidate being swiped from its display, and they called police. The naked Trump statue has popped up in several cities across the country.
How big are the hands?
Why would you want
huge hands?
And only in Florida do police leave a note to marijuana growers that their plants have been confiscated. Our news partner News for Jax reports an off-duty Alachua County deputy found 16 potted cannabis plants while walking his dog Tuesday night right near an elementary school. After the deputy found them, the police responded, collected the plants, and stored them, and they left a note behind, letting the owner of the plants know what had happened to them. It said, "We have your weed. Call 911 to identify and claim it. Thanks, GPD."
Go Gators.
Thanks to our media panel, A.G. Gankarski, Claire Goforth, Lindsay Kilbride, and Tessa Duvall. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
And thank you, and we'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
From the panhandle to the peninsula, the Sunshine State's politics are as hot as the weather. Trump versus Clinton, the race for the U.S. Senate, new political boundaries, and familiar issues. Join 89.9 every Friday at 1 p.m. for Decision Florida. Let your voice be heard.
In 1933, Alan Hovhaness was a young composer fascinated by astronomy. While reading Dante's Divine Comedy, he stumbled across the line, "O human race born to fly upward." That line sparked 50 years of musical ideas inspired by the idea of space travel. Listen for Star Dawn by Hovhaness on the next performance today from 8 p.m.
Weeknights at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, photography used to be connected to the darkroom, a process that spanned centuries. But even with digital image capture and technology advances, some photographers still long to connect with those old-fashioned physical aspects of making pictures. A new exhibit at MoCA called Retrospective focuses on artists who explore those 19th century photographic processes. Denise Reagan is with Mocha and joins us now. This sounds interesting. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
So these are like old-fashioned tinnotypes or daguerreotypes, kind of?
Right. We have daguerreotypes by Adam Foos. We have tintypes by Joni Sternbach, of surfers, no less. We have photograms. We have chemograms. We have camera obscura being used by Richard Learoyd. So a wide variety of processes.
Do they use old-fashioned cameras?
Yeah, you know, some of them are using cameras, but a lot of these don't even use cameras in the way that you might think.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, a lot of these processes don't use cameras the way that we think of them.
They use modern technology to create an old-fashioned looking image.
Right. Well, I mean, they're using the old technology, like a camera obscura. Richard Learoyd, you know, creates a studio-sized camera obscura with a pinhole. You know, remember the pinhole cameras you used to have when you were a kid.
Mm-hmm.
To create his pieces. And then some of the photographers are using the chemical processes of photography without actually creating a exposure in a camera that we think of, today.
How did this all come about? Is this a movement in the photography world?
Well, I mean, I think when digital photography started to take hold for the modern world, there were still always photographers who were very interested in the historical processes, the tactile sensation, the hand of the artist in the process. And so that's never gone away. But I think what has happened is more experimentation, what you can do with these old processes. And that's what these photographers have really shown us.
This exhibit is up now, correct?
It is up now. It's we have a members preview tonight, and then it opens to the public tomorrow on Saturday.
Tomorrow's the big night.
Yes.
There are so many great exhibits at MoCA Jacksonville. Come on downtown, make a night of it, have a drink, check out this new exhibit. It's called Retrospective, MoCAJacksonville.org for more information. Denise, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, Olympic figure skater Michelle Kwan, the gold medalist, was in town last week to campaign for Hillary Clinton. Kwan is more than a celebrity surrogate. She also has a paid role in the Clinton campaign. Take a listen. Michelle Kwan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are a high-profile surrogate for the Hillary Clinton campaign. You are not the first celebrity endorser of Hillary Clinton, of course, or high-profile woman to endorse her campaign. What motivated you to get involved at this level?
I had the honor to work for Secretary Clinton. So when I finished competing, I retired from my Olympic career in figure skating, I ended up going back to school, got my degree, focused on international relations and political science, master's degree in foreign policy, and then I worked at the Department of State and, saw firsthand Hillary Clinton's vision and leadership. And, when the opportunity came about, I said, how can I help and where do I sign up?
Right. And not only are you a celebrity surrogate, you are also a paid staffer. That's sort of an unusual role, isn't it?
I am a full-time staff. I'm usually more behind the scenes. I am the surrogate outreach coordinator on the campaign. A lot of people are like, what is the surrogate? So Hillary tries to be everywhere. You see her sometimes from Florida to California in one day. It's like, how is that possible? But we have people who have endorsed. We have elected officials from Senator Cory Booker to Senator Gillibrand to you name it, elected officials. And you have, the Demi Lovatos, the Katy Perrys, the Tony Goldwyns, the celebrity power to really be on the road, helping with voter registration, helping drive, get out the vote, our priority. And that's what part of my job entails. But also sometimes I'm also on the road and being a surrogate myself.
And do you think celebrity surrogates make a difference in a close election?
Well, I think everything makes a big difference. We are making sure that we are doing as much as we can. The real push, in Florida is making sure that the students are registered to vote. They know the deadline's on the 11th of October, making sure that in some states there's early voting, making sure that people know that November 8th, they got to get to the polls and vote. Across the board with celebrity surrogates, they have a power to use their platform, whether it's tweeting and amplifying Hillary's message via social media, doing a video for us, or hitting, you know, the trail and campaigning for us.
Let me ask you as well, in recent days, of course, Hillary Clinton has responded to a couple of controversies, one involving her revealing she has pneumonia after falling faint at a 9/11 observance in New York. The other, her comment about Donald Trump supporters falling into what she called a basket of deplorables. What's your response to those who have pointed to those incidents as confirming their perception of Secretary Clinton as writing off Republicans or disdaining Republicans and also not being transparent enough with the public and with the media?
Well, as an Olympian, I have to say that I've been on the campaign for over a year since Hillary announced last year. And, you know, I think of her stamina. She has the stamina of an Olympic athlete, as a triathlete. Sometimes it amazes me, you know, how much she travels and how many people she has connected in one day. It's rather superhuman, but, you know, if it were up to her, she'd plow through it. And I think right now she's getting some needed, you know, R&R, but she's going to hit the road on Thursday and she's going to be back on the campaign trail tomorrow.
And when we hear a follow-up conversation about Secretary Clinton characterizing Donald Trump supporters or a good chunk of them as being in a basket of deplorables, and by that she meant racist, sexist, homophobic, jingoistic, etc. What's your reaction to the criticism and the discussion that's arisen out of that remark?
Well, I think that she was referring to, you know, Trump's remarks oftentimes, the language in which he uses. And I think, you know, he is a very divisive, and the rhetoric he uses is very dangerous.
And so how do you see this matchup in terms of your endorsement of Hillary Clinton? You are a strong advocate for her as the best choice. Can you explain why you feel so strongly?
Well, it's simply put, when you see the two candidates that are running, you have one that is really, you know, talking very in terms of dangerous and divisive rhetoric, somebody that's talking about building walls to divide us. And then you have a candidate, Hillary Clinton, that's talking about bringing the country and uniting the country together, that's stronger together, you know, that is talking about building ladders of opportunity for Americans, building a better and stronger economy, shattering the glass ceiling. You know, she has put together comprehensive plans across the board, and it's all available online. And when people say, where does she stand on climate change? Where does she stand on this? She has a plan for all of it because, you know, she has experience and she knows what it takes. And so on day one, she's prepared and ready to tackle the challenges.
Now, on a more personal note, you're not figure skating anymore so much. So after this election is over, what are you going to do?
I really can't even. I think November 9th, I am going to get some sleep. I am going to see my husband. I'm going to see my family. I also embarrassingly have to admit that I'm going to get some dental work.
You've been putting that off?
Some necessary things. But yeah, the next 54 days were, it's nonstop. You know, from the beginning of the campaign, you said it's going to be a marathon. Now it's really the sprint to the end.
Olympic gold medalist Michelle Kwan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And finally, this hour, the Ramallah Club of Jacksonville is hosting a unique musical event tonight. It's the Daluna Ensemble, a group of musicians from the West Bank who have performed at concert venues around the globe. Their founder, Ramzi Aberdawan, was the subject of a book, Children of the Stone. It tells the story of his childhood growing up in a Palestinian refugee camp where his family fled and relocated after 1948 and where violence was par for the course. he turned to music as a way out. Ramsey joins us now along with Children of the Stone author Sandy Tolan. Good morning to you both. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
Good morning.
Ramsey, let's begin with you. You were a kid in the West Bank who, we've seen these photos many, many times, a young kid throwing stones at the Israeli soldiers. You started out that way?
Yes, that's actually was in the beginning of the first Intifada. Mm-hmm. And me and my friends, when we just saw the jeeps coming into the camp, the army jeep, we just reacted and took the stone and threw it on this jeep to just let them go out of the camp.
And how did you go from throwing stones to mastering music and founding a musical group that's taken you all over the world?
Yes. Actually, music, throwing stone and playing music, it gave me always the same feeling and expression, looking for freedom. Going from stone to music, I always have dreamed to play music when I was young, but actually my family didn't have the opportunity and resources to make me study music. I just discovered music by accident in 1996 and then started.
What was the accident?
It's through a friend of mine who I was usually selling her newspaper and cleaning her garden in Albira city near to the camp, Al-Amari. And then she suggested to a relative from her family who was coming after the Oslo agreement with the 120,000 people who were allowed to come back to involve me in this workshop as a kid from the camp, because the workshop was supposed to be giving for those who had the money to pay for this workshop.
I see. So in your book, Children of the Stone, Sandy, you tell the story of Ramsey. Why did you pick him?
Well, you know, I was doing research at the time for my previous book, The Lemon Tree, which is the story of an Israeli and a Palestinian, and the symbolic house that they both shared at different times or lived in at different times. And while I was doing that research, I saw this poster, that image of Ramsey with the stone, and next to it on the same poster was Ramsey playing the viola, and I thought, what is this? And it was right after the Oslo Accords had been signed, or relatively soon after, and Ramsey in a sense, was a symbol of this hope at the time that there could be two states living side by side in peace, Israel and Palestine. So I found him in his refugee camp where he was raised by his grandparents. And I'm a public radio veteran myself and did a long piece for Weekend Edition in 1998, and during which I asked him, you know, what's your dream of doing this? I was so drawn by this poster because it just symbolized the two mm-hmm. possibilities. And but at the time I said, you know, Ramsey, what's your dream? And he said, well, I want to be in the First National Symphony Orchestra of the State of Palestine, and I want to come back once he had just gotten a fellowship to study in France, and I want to come back and I want to open up music schools for the children of Palestine. We lost touch for almost 10 years, and lo and behold, 10 years later, I walked into a restaurant. There was Ramsey, and he told me he had opened up music schools for the children of Palestine. And for the next 5 years, I spent chronicling, writing and essentially a biography of Ramsey from his childhood, but also the drama of what it was like to open a music school in the middle of a military occupation and what it means for these kids to have this in their lives.
Yeah, sure. And that ended up becoming the Da Luna Ensemble. We're going to start listening to that now. Here's a little bit of their music. And as we listen to this, Ramsey, you'll be performing with the ensemble tonight at the Ramallah Club in Jacksonville. Sandy Tolan will be signing copies of his book there. Your first concert here, yes?
Yes, that's our first
concert. And never been to Jacksonville before?
Never. This is the first time.
What are your thoughts so far?
We're very happy and glad to share our music and story with the people of Jacksonville and with also the our colleague who are from Ramallah, because the club is from the people of Ramallah, and I grew up in this city. I mean, I was living in the camp just for sleeping, but most of my time spent in the city of Ramallah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so now, though, are you a citizen of the world? You're just traveling a lot, taking your music all over the world?
Yes, exactly. That's yeah. the case.
Yeah. And what's it like for you, Sandy, to do an appearance where the subject of your book is performing as you talk about the book?
I mean, it's been fantastic. This is something we dreamed about. We just sort of imagined. I went to the West Bank. I've probably been 20 times over the last 20 years, and 6 or 7 times for this book. And I spent so many hours talking with Ramzi and actually a couple hundred out of the people I interviewed. But we thought this would be an opportunity to bring not only the beauty of Palestinian culture and music, because people associate the region with so much pain and violence and sadness, and there's a lot of that, and it's in this book, but there's also the drama and the beauty and how music can be a thing to celebrate and to give actual protection for these kids. And so that all sort of comes together in the reading. I do a short reading, then I introduce Ramzi, and then it's the music, and people really, really engage with this music.
We're going to listen to a little bit more of the Daluna Ensemble as we thank author Sandy Tolan. The book is Children of the Stone, and Ramzi Aberdawan, founder of the Daluna Ensemble. Again, their appearance is tonight at the Ramallah Club at 7 p.m. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Good to be here. Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Diane Reams up next with her Friday News Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and we'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Enjoy the music. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.